Welcome, everyone, to session 132, which is Clothing God. It'll be a presentation by Carrie McLaughlin, and she's going to speak for about a half hour, and then we should have a good chance to interact with these ideas. These are powerful ideas about how we shape God versus we're going to eliminate any naivete that we might have about how those kinds of dynamics work. Before we begin, let's do the Sunstone spiel stuff, which is please make sure your cell phones are off or silenced in some way. Please be respectful in any interactions that you may have at the microphone or in these sessions. Sunstone reserves the right to have you removed, should you not be able to pull that off. The session's being recorded. You'll be able to purchase it at the end of the symposium registration desk. If they're doing it like they did last year, it'll be like a flash drive that you could just load whatever sessions you'd like on it. It's a wonderful way to do it. Please subscribe to Sunstone Magazine. Seven for the price of six is also there. Consider purchasing those cool Skull Candy headphones for only $25, normally like a $40 set of headphones. That also goes to support Sunstone. Benchmark Books is always a great place to purchase things. Carolyn Pearson is just walking in, and if you haven't got her book, you better go to Benchmark immediately. They're going to be flying off the shelf. Anyway, let's go in. Let me introduce Carrie here. As you can tell from the program, there's a couple of boring things here. She's an adjunct instructor in the Department of Philosophy and Religion at Western Carolina University, and that's in Cullowhee, Carolina. And she currently teaches online courses in American Indian religious traditions. She got her PhD within the last 10 years. It seems like we knew each other when you got it.
I'm ABD.
Oh, she's ABD. Oh, okay. In Native American Studies, UC Riverside, if it's my memory. Yeah, on that, stuff like that. But she's got a powerful mind, and she's teaching these courses. She's published on the significance of dogs in American Indian cosmologies. She and Jim, her husband here, are the co-editors of Element, which is the journal of the Society for Mormon Philosophy and Theology, which I'm a board member of as well. And they're just powerful people. And it's Carrie is the shy one of these two, but she's powerful. And I can tell by all of you who came here, you know that this is going to be substantive and wonderful. And so please welcome Carrie McLaughlin.
Thank you and good morning. Yesterday we were thinking that we might have to cancel as we were driving across the Mojave Desert and got a flat tire. And then our spare tire, one of those little tiny things, you know, was almost flat too. So Jim changed it and we made it back to where we could get some air, and we made it to where we could actually buy new tires, which was quite an ordeal, but anyway, we're here. In my sophomore year of high school, we read the Old Testament in seminary. It was Release Time Seminary in Blackfoot, Idaho. One night, I reread what I would later learn is known as the Abrahamic Covenant. The promise made to Abraham, then Isaac, and Jacob of a land of promise, a numerous posterity, and that those descendants would be a blessing to the world. I must have recently received my patriarchal blessing at that time, because this blessing, this Abrahamic covenant, sunk deep and really made a great impression upon me. I went to my room and offered a prayer of thanksgiving. While doing so, I experienced an overpowering manifestation of God's love for me, and then immediately God's love extending outward to all. Wrapped in the light of that love, I was able to experience divine love, a love far beyond my capacity and beyond what I had ever experienced before or have experienced since. At this time, I accepted the revelation as confirmation that the church, the restoration, and the Book of Mormon were all true. I had, I believe, the testimony based on the solid foundation of revelation. several years later, I took my first class in philosophy and began to comprehend the relative nature of truth. Then, after having graduated from Brigham Young University, married, and had my first baby, I read Donna Hill's book on Joseph Smith. Here's the Abrahamic Covenant, sorry. I'm going to have to remember to change the slides here. It didn't change. I guess I have to do it twice. I think I have to do it twice for it to change. Okay, thank you. So I read Donna Hill's Joseph Smith, the First Mormon. My understanding of Joseph Smith became complicated by the information I gained there. Joseph Smith was and still remains an important cultural hero. But especially difficult for me to square is polygamy and kingdom building, and particularly the inducement used to persuade 14-year-old Helen Mar Kimball to marry Joseph Smith, that it would ensure the eternal salvation of herself and her family. Around the same time, and this was more than 30 years ago, there were other things that began to chip away at the foundation of my testimony of the church. Another particularly vexing one was when we heard, my husband and I heard Ed Ashman speak about how the Book of Abraham is not a translation of the papyrus on which it was supposed to be based. I did not know how to fit these new revelations into my worldview, and my world continued to crumble. In a graduate course in religion and literature at Indiana University, I read Julian of Norwich. We've got her right. Julian of Norwich. She was born around 1342 and lived during the time of the Great Plague in England. She became an anchoress, and people aren't sure exactly what that entailed, if that was close to a nun or if she just lived a mostly secluded life or what it exactly meant. But at the age of 30, she grew ill and almost died. During this perilous state, she had a revelation of Christ. She later struggled to understand her revelation, as there were things that she experienced that did not conform with aspects of her Catholic tradition. In writing of her experience, she speaks of Christ in familial terms and likens the relationship of the Christian to Christ as that of child to mother. And Christ, like a mother, nurtures a child from conception through labor and nursing and by instruction to adulthood and beyond. Julian of Norwich did not see hell. For her, hell is the recognition of sin and its accompanying distress, but she saw no hell as a physical place, not as a place of torment to which people would eternally be consigned. So she had difficulty accepting the church's teachings of hell that were incompatible with her own revelation and of a God of love who forgives. She wrote, "For I saw no wrath except on man's side, and he forgives that in us, for wrath is nothing else but a perversity and an opposition to peace and to love." And I also thought it was interesting that she wrote that God sees us as perfect and waits for the day when human souls mature so that evil and sin will no longer hinder us. But as I read Julian's accounts, and she read a couple of accounts and struggled to, try to explain her vision and her revelation over several years. So as I read her account, I reflected on my own revelation. I realized that the actual message I received was that of God's overwhelming love. I had not received the message relating to the truth claims of my church. The church and its truth claims had become so much part of my identity, however, that this was very much a crisis. Around this time, I was reading Matthew 25, where the Son of Man at Judgment Day rewards his followers for their generous natures. And it reads in 35 and 36, "For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me." I will later return to a discussion of the meaning of these and subsequent verses, but for now I will concentrate on the words, "Naked, and ye clothed me." This phrase hit me forcefully with an interpretation different from the standard one. I thought about how each of us clothes God and clothes Christ in various ways according to our different understanding and experience. In the Book of Mormon, it says that God reveals to us according to our understanding. And then, of course, we're all familiar with the idea of growing line upon line and precept upon precept. It comforted me to consider that each of us grows line upon line and precept upon precept. We are each in a process of development. I realized I could allow others to believe as they did, and that if our views were not the same, that was okay. We could coexist in the same church. There are various ways individuals throughout the world have envisioned or clothed God. Jesus himself seems to have clothed God in very familial terms, in very personal terms. He spoke the Aramaic language. Though he may have known Hebrew and Greek, Aramaic was the spoken language. The only Aramaic word Christ is said to have spoken is the name he called God, Abba. And this is a departure from the Jewish norms, which would have addressed God with more formal terms. And even if addressing God as Father would have been the formal Father, but Abba is the child's term, like Daddy or Papa. While praying in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus is quoted as saying, "Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Take away this cup from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what thou wilt." That's in Mark 14:36. It is rare within Judaism to call God Abba. Jesus expressed here an intimacy with God. And according to John, though not recorded in the Synoptic Gospels, Jesus is supposed to have voiced a close affinity between himself and God, saying, "He that hath seen me hath seen the Father. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father in me." And this is also echoed again in Doctrine and Covenants 93:3. This view of a daddy God did not remain the dominant form in Christianity, however. Christian theologians would eventually favor a philosophical God, quite removed from humanity, far from the loving God that Julian of Norwich saw in her vision, and far from the God that Jesus seems to have envisioned. According to the authors of the book Saving Paradise, early Christian art centers on baptism, healing, and the resurrected Christ. And the authors indicate that in the 6th century St. Apollinaire Nouveau Church, they found the earliest surviving life story of Jesus depicted in images. And then on the right wall near the chancel, there's the image of the Last Supper, and then the 13 scenes of the Passion. And at panel 10, they encountered Simon of Cyrene carrying the cross for Jesus to Golgotha. And they say that they expected to see the crucifixion on panel 11. But instead, they were confronted by an angel who sat before a tomb. The apparition spoke to two women swaying forward like gospel choir singers. We too leaned forward in astonishment and remembered, "He is not here." the angel said, "He is not here." The remaining panels show the risen Christ visiting his followers in the stories of Doubting Thomas and the road to Emmaus. So they looked at, you know, all of the images they could find, early Christian art, and all the extant, you know, images that remain. And they did not find any focus on the dead Christ. They found focus on Christ's life and focus on the resurrected Christ. But in the Middle Ages, beginning with the era of Charlemagne and the forceful subjugation, here's another quotation. They said, "We found no crucifixions. We found no crucifixions in any of Ravenna's early churches. The death of Jesus, it seemed, was not a key to meaning, not an image of devotion, not a ritual symbol of faith for the Christians who worshipped among the church's glittering mosaics. The Christ they saw was the incarnate risen Christ, the child of baptism, the healer of the sick, the teacher of his friends, and the one who defeated death and transfigured the world with the spirit of life." They said, "We could not find a dead Jesus, not even one. It was just as the angel had said to the women looking for Jesus at the tomb, 'Why do you look for the living among the dead?'" Okay, now we'll go to the Middle Ages. Beginning with the era of Charlemagne and the forceful subjugation of the Saxons, a new Christian emphasis began to emerge around the dead, crucified Christ. Rather than a joyful acceptance into the community of Christ through baptism, the Saxons were threatened with the sword and were killed if they would not become Christians. The authors of this work, Brock and Parker, indicate that the new vision concentrates on the terrors of Christ's death and his role as an intermediary between humanity and a vengeful God. And I'm not going to read all of this, but just a little bit. Charlemagne's Roman Rite, imposed throughout his empire, was an abandonment of an earlier rite that focused on the wondrous human body sanctified by Christ's incarnation. In coming to the communion table, worshipers now would face the crucified Christ, who both exposed and condemned unrepentant sinners for their crimes. By the late 9th century, Carolinian illuminated manuscripts included Christ dead on the cross, his eyes closed and his blood flowing. Images of Christ's blood spurting from his side and filling a chalice were produced for the first time during this period. The dead Christ would appear in Rhineland's churches within the second half of the 10th century and multiply throughout Europe in the ensuing centuries. And here is the Gerald Cross, the earliest that known crucifixion where Christ is dead, and obviously dead, with his eyes closed. The use of Christianity to subjugate others at the point of the sword was an important aspect during the Crusades as well. It was also used in the conquest of the New World. Conquistadors frequently read American Indians their rights to convert in a language they did not understand, and if they rebelled against the conquest, felt entirely justified in taking their lands and lives by power of the sword. Europeans... I'm kind of debating whether I think I will do this, but just a really quick example of a Cherokee and Aztec way of clothing God. So I'll go ahead and do this, but I don't want to go too far over my half hour. But Europeans sometimes characterized American Indians as having no religion or of worshiping demons. The Cherokee tradition, like many American Indian traditions, is esoteric, so it is not known well. But through the bits and pieces that have been shared, we can gather that the Cherokee had a belief. Oh, and here's just, you know, images of Christ that we have as a good shepherd, or, you know, as the dead Christ who's going to come back and kick butt. All right. Since I have this slide here, Andre Bergson in Two Sources of Morality and Religion, if we look back at what I have been talking about with Christianity, you know, the change from Christ talking about God in familial terms, and this, but then the institution creates this image of Christ as the dead Christ, and that you have to, and that Christ has to atone for your sins and is an intermediary between you and a wrathful God. It seems like that's a kind of a change in emphasis over time. Andre Bergson indicates that there are two sources of morality and religion. One is the open source, the élan vital, the revelation itself that comes directly to a person and is felt and experienced. And he calls this the creative source of religion, and he also connects it with love. And then the other source, the second source, is the closed source. And this is the institution. But the institution isn't bad. The institution preserves the revelation. It preserves the scriptures. And so you can, over time, still remember that Christ called Father, Abba. And you can remember the, you know, some of the words that Christ used because of the scriptures that are preserved by the institution. But if the institution becomes too rigid, then it's no longer able to continue to contain that revelation, and it becomes completely closed. But anyway, so we can kind of see that going on in Christianity, but because Christianity preserves the scriptures and preserves the revelation, we still have the image of the Good Shepherd, as well as the vengeful God who's going to judge humanity. But anyway, I think I'm going to skip the Cherokee thing. I'll just, no? Oh, okay, all right. Okay. Okay. All right. Well, I am most familiar in the Native American tradition with the Cherokee tradition. And there is a being, a supreme being, according to some accounts. But there's not much known about that supreme being. I'll get to it a little bit, of what is known. But there is a wonderful story which we could compare to the Adam and Eve story, and that is of Shelu and her husband Kanati. But I'm going to focus on Shelu. Shelu is the mother, the corn mother, and the mother of two boys. One of them is a wild boy who is not born in the usual manner, and his name translates, he who grew up wild, and the other was the normal boy. But they are considered to be twins. And so the wild boy always comes up with ideas that cause trouble. But one day he wonders where their mother gets the food that she feeds them, the beans and the corn that she gets from the storehouse each day. So he says, why don't we go follow her? So they do. They go and they follow her to the storehouse. Then they peek through the cracks and see what their mother does. And when she goes in to the storehouse, she rubs underneath her armpits and produces corn, and rubs her belly and produces beans. The food comes from her body. So Wild Boy says, she's a witch. We've got to kill her. And so when the mother finds out, you know, she reads their thoughts. She knows what they are going to do. And she says, your minds are full of evil and you're perplexed. and I know you're going to kill me. But before you do, I want to give you some instructions. And so she tells them to drag her body around prepared soil seven times. And then the seeds come from her body, and she tells them how to tend the crops until the corn is grown up, waving above their heads, and then to give thanks to her. And then she says that she will be on earth to sustain them as well as above. And she talks about the love that she continues to have for them. So I think that that is a wonderful story about a love of a mother for her children, even when they don't do things that are right. But the Supreme Being, the Cherokee Supreme Being, is Sana La Nuhi. And it has been translated differently by different people. James Mooney and Franz Olbrecht translated this as the portioner, meaning and likened it to the sun and the moon that apportion time. But Anna Kilpatrick, who's actually a Cherokee speaker and grew up in the Cherokee tradition, says that this is wrong, that it's actually the provider. And that she and her husband associate the provider with fire and the sun, which fire is a manifestation of the sun on earth. But it's also, they indicate that this is a supreme being. But because of the esoteric nature of the tradition, you know, we can't really tease this out any further. I can only suggest that in the Lakota tradition, which the Lakota language is in the same linguistic family as the Iroquoian languages, which Cherokee is a part. There's the Cherokee and Iroquoian language family is supposed to be one language family. But anyway, in the Lakota tradition, at least according to some sources, there is 16 beings, important beings, 4 times 4, Tob-Tob, 4 times 4 equals 16, and they each have names. But also, these 16 may be 16 different gods, or they may be 16 manifestations of one god. And so, you know, and also Lakota, like other Native American traditions, is an esoteric tradition. It's hard to really, really know. But then I will just briefly mention a book that I have been reading recently called Aztec Philosophy. And Aztec is the language, Nahual is Udo-Aztecan language. But in it, according to James Maffey, they have a supreme being. And despite all of the different manifestations of Aztec beings, like Tlaloc, who is the god of rain, and all of these different beings, Quetzalcoatl, just to name a couple, there is one reality behind all manifestations and one reality behind everything, and that is a divine energy. And so we are all, the trees, everything is all manifestation of this divine energy. And so anyway, I just bring this up to show you a couple of ways that Native Americans have envisioned or clothed God. And they certainly aren't barbaric or, you know, a satanic ways of envisioning God. Feuerbach has suggested that we cast or clothe God in our own nature as a personification of our highest values. If we value power, we cast God as a king with regal adornments and the power to work his will over all things. If we cast Christ or God as a humble teacher, we revere the narratives of his birth in a stable, bedded in a manger, and raised by his loving mother Mary. He's known as the carpenter's son, or even as the bastard son of a Roman soldier. with reference to his conception out of wedlock, the way that many people would have viewed Jesus, who was conceived before his mother was married. But as Feuerbach write, do we cast or clothe God in according to the personification of our highest values? Well, I think that there is some truth to it. But when the clothes with which a tradition clothes God are offered as a reflection of a best understanding of God's nature based on a founding revelation, and if this clothing reflects a genuine desire to be true to God's nature as we understand it, we must allow that this is an honest and genuine religious impulse. Even if we disagree in certain particulars, we might be able to find common ground if we do not use our conception of God to inflict harm on others. Now, I would like to come back where did I put that? Come back to Matthew 25, where the Son of Man at Judgment Day rewards his sheep for their generous natures. For I was an hungered, and ye gave me meat. I was thirsty, and ye gave me drink. I was a stranger, and ye took me in. Naked, and ye clothed me. I was sick, and ye visited me. I was in prison, and ye came unto me. Then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when saw we thee an hungered and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? When saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked and clothed thee? Or when saw we thee sick or in prison and came unto thee? And the king shall answer and say unto them, Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of the least of these my brethren, ye have done it unto me. At the time I reflected on this scripture more than 30 years ago in terms of clothing God, I was familiar with Tolstoy's short story, Where Love Is, of Martin the shoemaker who had a dream after reading this scripture. And the images that I am showing here are from a children's book that we read to our children. It was a beloved children's book. In his dream, so Martin falls asleep while he's reading Matthew 25. And in his dream, Christ says that he will visit Martin the next day. So Martin wakes up early to prepare. He waits and watches for Christ all day, but only sees people in need of help. He notices and offers a break and refreshment to a man shoveling snow. There's the man shoveling snow or sweeping snow. Then he offers his own coat to the ill-clad woman with a baby who is going to go visit her husband who is in the war. And finally, he mediates between a boy who has stolen an apple from a lady who is selling apples on the street, and he leaves them friends assisting one another. But that night, as Martin returned to his scriptures, he again fell asleep. And Christ appeared to him in a dream, and Christ said, I had such a wonderful day with you today, Martin. And Martin says, What do you mean? I waited for you all day, and you didn't come. And then before Martin's mind came the images of the man sweeping snow, the woman with the baby, and the little boy and the woman selling apples. And then the words came to him, Inasmuch as ye have done it to the least of these, my brethren, ye have done it unto me. This ethic, the golden rule, is a fairly universal religious truth. In accordance with my own religious experience, the most appropriate way to clothe God is as part of an ethical relationship with another being. We read in 1 John, "If a man say, 'I love God,' and hateth his brother, he is a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen?" At the core of my testimony is a revelation of God that Joseph Smith offered, that each being is a free, uncreated being, and that we are literally sons and daughters of divine parents and have the seeds of divinity within us, so that we have the opportunity and potential to be infinitely perfectible. To love God and to love our neighbor as ourselves is to honor the divine persons we are.
Take this into personal realms for everybody here. How do you clothe God?
There are images of female gods. The Mesopotamian ones are pretty well known of fertility deities. There are images of a female god, early Hebrew, at least inscriptions dedicated to Asherah, who's the consort of Yahweh. And so these were, fairly common, I believe, in the ancient world. In the Bible, we read about how the Queen of Heaven was subjugated. She was put down. Her images were taken away from the temple. And so you can read that, read about that. Shelu, the Cherokee Corn Mother, I consider that for the Cherokee, she is, a powerful image of a divine being. She, oversees them from above, and they would pray to her for assistance, and would provide food for them. But yeah, there are lots of images of women deities.
In the New Testament, at least the Gnostics speak of Jesus
Thank you. And I would like to say that in a lot of Native American thought, each male important being is paired with a female being. There seems to be a duality, male and female, like with the yin and yang of the, you know, Taoist tradition. One thing that came to my mind is something, a quotation that my husband sometimes gives from Brigham Young. If the Book of Mormon were to be translated today, it would be translated differently. And I hope that if that were the case, that it would include the revelation of Heavenly Mother. And I was thinking about talking about something that I didn't bring up, and that was B.H. Roberts's view of God as a generic God, God as a community. They had a lot of rich ideas, you know, that they weren't afraid to develop. And this idea of God as a community, that our ancestors are up there working for us. And even though I hadn't read B.H. Roberts at the time as I was a child, and my parents weren't even active, I still had this sense of ancestors watching over me. And one time I had this one experience, and I felt that my great-grandmother had been watching over me. And so I think in the folk tradition, a lot of times there are these powerful images, and at least we have, you know, the song that teaches us that we do have a mother in heaven. And we can build on that, and I hope that we continue to build on that. And I hope that it is the case that I think of that scripture as a man might stretch forth his puny arm to stop the flow of the mighty Missouri River. You know, so, you know, it's impossible for us to stop the revelations of God from coming. And I hope that that is the case, and I believe that will be the case. It will probably take time, as far as a mother in heaven and recognition of the importance of female.
Oh, just a second, Janice. Jim, it seemed like you had something right on Carolyn's.
Yeah,
oh, okay.
There is, you know, the Cormac Cardinals, or the tiny little animals that are carrying around. Yeah, well, actually performing half one of those is referring to Proverbs, which speaks of the Holy Wisdom, the whole time, you know. He basically says that we don't look too different than her. Yeah, so that there is a kind of story.
I have a couple of words in the book of the Bible like that.
It's there. But there's also a passage, you know, in Moses 6:9, talking about God creating us in the image of the Lord God and the only king.
Sure, we know all that.
At least we have a theological foundation to build upon.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And we have 12 or 13 more minutes, so I'm going to just stick with Carolyn's theory just one more time, or at least her thing. You know, a lot of times within the Book of Mormon, or when I relate to the Book of Mormon, I can think inside the story and outside the story. I can think of it the way that you've presented it here, if the Native Americans really are in these pages or not. Within that, you can at least, there's a couple of thoughts that I have, and most of them just have to do with the imperfection of who Mormon is. He's a general. He's always worried. He doesn't really. He's commenting on things. He's selecting things that are interesting to him. I think it's his words when you have the descriptions of the Native Americans as wild and ferocious and basically heathen and everything, you know, despicable about them. And yet, every once in a while, he can't help it. He has to put in a story in there that, like, what's the best marriage we've ever seen in the Book of Mormon? It's the one with King Lamoni's father and his wife, you know, or something like that. And so his own things that if indeed this is the story of a guy who did select within the stuff he counteracts the other stuff here. But if it's also a dynastic history, if it's who won gets to write the history, he's a Nephite. He really never got into the stuff. So it's possible that those are among the things that he was just completely ignorant of. But then when you think outside the story, Carrie might know, are there things from Asia, if we talk about the land bridge and who the original people were, whether those connections are there or not is an interesting thing to me.
Yeah,
I'm not trying to be a Book of Mormon apologist at all.
It's interesting. It's been too long since I taught world religion, so I'm... The Japanese sun goddess.
Amaterasu.
Yeah, there's quite a few. But Amaterasu is interesting in the in the Chinese, I mean, in the Japanese Shinto tradition, because she goes around this rock first, and she is the goddess of the sun. But then her husband says, no, I'm supposed to go around first. And so you can even see in this mythology this tension between the male and the female and this kind of thing. But in Japanese mythology, the sun is female. In Cherokee mythology, the sun is female. But those are minority positions as far as viewing the sun as female. But I would just like to say that Mormonism, there's no doubt, is very patriarchal. But we have to work against that, and we have to strive to revision. You know, we can't let the good things go and just throw it out. We need to struggle for the beautiful and the good and what we believe is true.
Okay. To add on to the plurality comment on the male and female counterparts of the CLA mentioned earlier, in the Hindu religion, they have not really a shrine, but they have a section of their house that is put on pictures of different gods and goddesses. And one of the things that I really like about the religion is if there's a photo of the god without the goddess, you have to have another photo with the goddess so they don't see the bad side of the god. And that.
Yeah, that's good. Yes, with every Hindu male god, there is a female as well. The Shakti, the power. Yeah. And Hindu is another interesting religious tradition that is so diverse. There's just, you know, it's very vast. But a lot of Hindus will adopt, as you say, a particular one, or ones with their consorts. But there's 330 million Hindu gods or one, or somewhere in between,
So, is gender just another gun put on God?
That's interesting. Is gender just a garment on us, too? In Native American traditions, there are several traditions where there is actually record of rebirth concepts in Native American traditions. And in the rebirth concepts that have been recorded, I don't know what you call it, but anyway, if you're male in this life, in the next life you'll be female, and or vice versa. So that, you know, everybody experiences being male and female.
For me, and for a lot of people, one of the biggest disservices that either Joseph Smith or LDS Mormonism offers is the concrete image of God. And as a young child growing up into adulthood, trying to connect with old, white-haired, white-dressed, floating in the sky God was incredibly difficult, both spiritually and mental health-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And through the deconstruction of and the loss of my childhood faith, very, very painful deconstruction. Because the only framework for God I had ever been given was white-haired old man standing in the sky, it had to completely fall to the point that I said, I am an atheist. I have no belief in God. There is nothing, no one. And at that point, when it was all completely gone, laid low, sand in my fingers, could I then start to God? Could I reconstruct that idea of God? And God through the scriptures is not a white man. He's a pillar of fire. He's a or she is a womb. He and God is one who is both genders, neither genders, transcends genders. But when we are given only one image in which to see God that is male, white, white-haired, we lose the ability to have those individual, personal connections. And as I rebuilt my relationship with God, I found an image arising that was a small, Middle Eastern, wise, spry, funny woman who would also allow me to put my head in her lap. And only when I developed a relationship in that image was I willing or able to, at the very distance, allow a male aspect of God to maybe peek in my area. So the idea of reclothing God is so crucial for people who don't fit that mold. So I appreciate this conversation.
Well, thank you. That
was wonderful.
That is wonderful. And I really feel what you're saying, too. I've had this experience. I took a class, a history course on the women's rights movement and feminism. And as I sat in sacrament meeting, I began to count the number of pronouns, male pronouns, and it's just almost exclusively male pronouns in the talks. And I, you know, was reflecting on how difficult it is for young women to find their place in the church when that is the case. And so, yeah, I hope and pray that it changes soon, because if it doesn't, you know, it's going to be a great loss, and we won't have a place.
Yeah, I'm guessing with Carol Lynn and Mother Wove of the Morning, you know, you studied all these things. You talked about this. This was quite a descriptive paper, but you almost need this kind of descriptive thing to sort of see something beautiful or something you can relate to in all these other different ways, it seems to me, so you can get prescriptive for yourself. You know what I mean? So that's this, like, it's, you need to enter into other cultures. You need to enter all these different things so you can say, oh, huh, there's other ways to do it. And then you do that active jobs that you're talking about and Carolyn talked about at the beginning. But I think we have time for one more question, just 2 or 3 minutes left. If anyone wants to.
No.
Wendy, yay!
I realized, even though this has just getting started, that unless I'm not very much like the rest of you. I think I was a very much like most Mormon human beings, and I've actually officially resigned my membership, but I also, it's not that it's like you, because I no longer see an anthropomorphic God, a very personal God. And I'm very concerned about the spiritual, and I kind of do like community church, and where the stress is on the unknowable, the divine is unknowable, and so, you know, I know quote God is a metaphor, but still there's that suggestion of the anthropomorphic which we close people. So I can kind of fit in my new conception of what the divine is. And I know you spoke so much, you talked about community, you know, about community and our relationships with other people. And that, I can make sense of that, I can understand that. But, you know, I know it's meaningful a lot, but for a lot of people who have a personal life, it's not very meaningful. I don't know if I personally need that, I guess. Mm-hmm. So, and also this idea that, I'm not just like trying to
Well, with a lot of mystic traditions, I was thinking of bringing this up too, but, you know, you could go off on lots of tangents, but mystics who experience God really have a difficult time talking about their experience because it's beyond language. And so it's very much a felt thing rather than something that you can express in language. But, and there was another thought I had, and I can't remember. Now it's left me. But I really like the generic concept of God, and actually, that's the way that I view God, ancestors working together for our good, and that we join in that effort after we die. And that's what I believe.
It's been a good hour, hasn't it? Thank you, Carrie, for all that you know and this field that you mine. Please share more with us in future years at Sunstone, too. So thank you.